You're listening to the Reading Envy podcast, where I'll have what you're reading. Hi, everyone. This is Jenny, and Lauren and I are here for a different kind of episode. We just want to talk about Science September, or I should say, hashtag Science September. But first, I just want to say that the podcast is now available in Spotify. So if you like to listen to music and other podcasts in Spotify, you can find Reading Envy there too. Now back to our conversation. Hi, Lauren.
Hi. Yes. Hashtag Science September.
So this is something that you kind of started in Instagram. Do you want to tell us a little bit about it?
Well, like you said, I don't know if I technically started it because I think a lot of other people might have been doing something, you know, like this in the past. I think what drew me to it initially was just the idea of alliteration and the cuteness factor. But then also looking at my bookshelves in my own home and realizing how many science books I had. And this was, you know, late July, early August. And I was like, oh, Science September, that's cute. Let's do it. And yeah, the hashtag only had, I don't know, maybe a handful of pictures in it. So I thought it would be a good place to add some more.
Yeah. And I think you read a lot of science in general, right?
I do. Yeah.
You read a lot of science, but I don't. So for you, it was like, I got to get through some of these books I already bought. And for me, it's like, I should read science.
Well, it can be both, of course. Yeah. And it's funny now, you know, looking back, I actually only read a handful of things, maybe like two or three on my own shelf. And then I had several ebooks from the library and like two library books that I got, you know, things like that. And I was like, oh, that didn't really help with my own shelf situation like I wanted to do in the first place. But yeah, well, all in the name of acquiring knowledge and getting more science in my brain. But I also really liked the opportunity to kind of bust out a little bit more of my own. You know, I read a ton of natural history science, and I really love reading about geology. I love reading about trees, botany, plants, which I know is a huge surprise for you. But this time, you know, I got it a little bit more. I kind of expanded my boundaries, both literally and physically, and got a lot more into some astronomy texts. I did a little bit more like medical stuff too, which isn't that much of a departure because I do read a lot about like human anatomy and physiology and disease and various things like that too. But then I read some bioethics book. I read, you know, a little bit more medicine. Things like that. So it was a lot of fun. And I enjoyed getting outside of my own bubble a little bit too.
Yeah, I found that too. I was drawn most to the nature-y books. And so then I tried to push myself beyond it, and that didn't necessarily work all that well. Mm-hmm. And I didn't finish half the books that I started in my science speed dating round either. So I'm like looking at them right here. I still have the book I started from Alaska. Oh, and the other book I started from Alaska.
Seeing a trend here.
And the third book I started from Alaska. Like, these are the books that I seriously have goals to read this year. And those are not the books I went back to. Oh, well, maybe in November.
Science November. Yeah. Now we need something that starts with an N. Nature. There you go. Nature November.
It's done. I have to do it.
I'll join.
So the other thing that I tried that was different is I don't think I've ever listened to a science audiobook. No, I'm lying. I just remembered. I've listened to that one about the periodic table before. Mm-hmm. I can't remember what that's called.
The disappearing spoon or something?
Yes, thank you. Good job. That's a great memory. The Disappearing Spoon has a really funny chapter in it. Well, it's not supposed to be funny, I don't think, but it's an interesting chapter about a man who was consuming silver because he felt like it had health benefits, and so his skin turned blue.
Oh my.
So that's really stuck with me over the years. But
yeah, that's definitely something that would stick out.
In general, yeah, though, I just don't, because you listen to a lot of nonfiction, right? But I tend not to. If I'm going to read nonfiction, I tend to read it in print.
I do both. Okay. Yeah. I think for this one, I was maybe about half-half, maybe more like two-thirds reading versus listening. Some of them, though, and I we've discussed this in the past, especially for things that have like some references that I want to follow up on, I'll often go and get the book at the library, or, you know, pick it up a cheap copy or a used copy or something like that, so that I can check some more of the references, especially if it's something I know I'll return to again. And I did that with three of the books from this list.
Wow.
I bought one, and the other two I got at the library. So that worked out well, because sometimes there's just things that, you know, you're just half listening to an audiobook, or you're cleaning or cooking or whatever that you do when you listen to an audiobook, and you're just not 100% attentive. And then you're like, oh, I want to read that again, or I want to check in on that, or I want to copy down a quote from it or something like that.
Yeah.
It's quite helpful.
It's a lot easier in print.
Yeah, exactly.
So did you want to talk about maybe we could start with your favorites? Do you want to start there?
Sure. So I ended up reading, I think, 12 books, specifically science books, over, you know, September 1st through 30th. And I will say I started one before, because I just couldn't wait. I was so excited about Science September. So no, I started two. I started two earlier. So I started Hallucinations by Oliver Sacks. And I started The Great Quake by Henry Fountain the last week of August. And I finished those up pretty soon, pretty quickly. Those were both great. I'm sure you and several of your listeners are familiar with Oliver Sacks and his books. This was probably my fifth or sixth of his books. And
wow.
I think this one was my favorite one of all. I really liked this Hallucinations book. Some of his earlier texts I found to be a little muddled, and you get mixed up because he talks a lot about his different patients and you kind of mix up who's who. This Hallucinations was very ordered, and he talked about different kinds of hallucinations. He got a lot more into like the neuroscience of it too, which I appreciated, and also just relatable, which was really cool. Mm-hmm. The Great Quake was a good one, and that had an Alaska connection as well, about the earthquake that happened, I believe, 1964, that was the second largest earthquake on record. I might get the number wrong, but I think it was a 9.2 on the Richter scale. And what was amazing is, you know, it was a pretty unpopulated area. It was just this very small island and town. And obviously the island and the tsunami that happened were extremely devastating natural wise, but because there weren't many people living there, luckily there were not too many people who were killed. There were still were some fatalities, but it was more that it just completely changed the geology of some of the spaces in Alaska. And they were able to figure out a lot more about different kinds of earthquakes, and specifically as it relates to that Cascadia fault that runs up along, you know, obviously through the Cascade Mountains and then up into BC and up into Alaska.
And isn't that the one where, like, it altered the height?
Yes.
Height isn't the right thing.
It
but, like,
altered,
by 30 feet or something?
And there's, like, different places. So there was all these, you know, geology students who went out and were looking for certain parts in the stratigraphy of the rocks, and they'd find it at different levels. So they were able to find that some areas rose up like 30 some feet.
Yeah. That's amazing.
It was incredible.
I feel like that gets mentioned in some of the other Alaskan books I've read this year. Like, it's a significant enough event that's related to almost all of it, whether it's settling the area or the nature part. Yeah.
Yeah, well, and I think the fact that it happened just a few years after statehood, too, it was just this very foundational, you know, for lack of a better word, a very foundational thing that happened in state history. But I liked that one because it had some good personal stories in it, too, about people who were living there and who experienced the quake as it was happening, and then things around it afterward. So those were my first two. And then I jumped into a book that's been on my list for a long time, one that I loved this author's first book and was excited to come back and read his second one. It was called The Song of Trees by David George Haskell. And he is a fascinating writer. He's, you know, kind of the natural history ilk. He's a professor down at Swanee in Tennessee, and he's British by birth, but I think he's lived in the U.S. now for several decades. So I don't know exactly how he identifies himself, but he really focuses specifically on American trees and American forests and natural history of those spaces. Mm. But The Song of Trees was just a beautiful text. So his first book was called Forest Unseen. And that's like a very micro history of this little patch of land that he watches over, I believe it's over a year. So that's his first book. And then this book, the second one, The Song of Trees, it takes that sort of same idea, but then makes it much larger, more of a macro scale. And he looks at several different trees in different areas of the of Earth. So, you know, he travels around to different spots, finds this one tree, and then tells a story about what's basically happening inside that tree, and then what's happening around the tree, how animals, including humans, interact with that tree, you know, what's happening in the soil. It's beautiful. And he just writes so well. So I'd recommend both of his books. But that was one of my top three for Science September this year. I really, really enjoyed that one.
And it seems to connect to the one that a lot of people who participated read, including me, which is The Hidden Life of Trees.
Yes, which I have not read yet, but like 5-6 people read it for that used the hashtag, at least. There may have been more.
Yeah, so I'm curious, like, if there's crossover between those two, because they seem like they're about kind of the same thing, maybe from a different approach. But
yeah,
the author of that one is Peter Wallabin, and he's a like a forestry person in Germany. And so his background and training is forestry. But in that book, I mean, he talks about how trees communicate, and it's basically all the science since the great, I don't remember the name of it, the Mushroom Network article that was in Nature, like in the 70s.
Yeah.
And so he kind of debunks some of the things he was taught in forestry, just about how it's the same to grow new trees as it is to have old ones, and those kinds of things that are really more about corporate gain than they are about forests. And he shows how the science and how what they've learned about how trees communicate with smell and odor. And it's just fascinating.
It really is. I'm looking forward to reading that one. I mean, it was already on my list, but the fact that so many of you read it, and I think almost overall had very good reviews of it.
Yeah.
But I'm curious too, how it relates, but since Song of Trees is still kind of in my consciousness, I need to get to the other one pretty soon so I can compare a little bit more.
Yeah. And I think my only thing was it was written so casually that I was looking a lot into the science, because it does come across a little bit, I don't want to say new agey, but you know, a little bit like the trees.
Yeah, well, the idea of like trees communicating and things like that. But it's not really, I mean, it seems a little woo woo, but when there is actually some things that back it up, and especially with the precedent of the fungi communication systems.
And, oh yeah, I wrote it down, the mycorrhizal fungal network.
Yeah. No, I knew exactly what you were talking about.
It's fascinating. Network. Yeah. So those seemed like they connected, which was kind of neat.
And that was one that you finished.
Yeah, I did. I only finished three. It's funny. I looked at a lot of books and I thought about a lot of books, but I only really finished three.
Well, you read a lot of other things too during the whole month.
That's true.
As always, you probably had like 23 that you read, or 33.
Yeah. And then there were some science ones that I was like, I sometimes push myself to try to keep going in something that I'm not enjoying rather than moving on to the next thing. And so I kind of got stuck a little bit on one, but.
I don't have that tendency. I tend to drop it fast if I'm not enjoying it.
That's good, I think.
There was one exception, and I will say I kept on going through this book, and I believe you'll know which one I'm talking about because I loved the cover so much.
Yes.
I was like, it's going to get better. It's going to get better. And because I just was like, the cover art's so beautiful, so of course it's going to get better, and it never did. And it was funny because one of the other people who participated in Science September, a friend of mine named Sean, who's up in Calgary, he books and beers at uh-huh. Books and Beers and on Instagram. He was like, I don't know why you didn't like this book. I thought it was so charming. And I was like, charming? Oh my gosh. I can't even, I don't know.
And which book was that?
That was, oh, I'm sorry. Ooh, I left you all like, what is it? It was Spineless. It was the book about jellyfish.
Yeah.
Julie Berwald, I believe is her name. And I just loved I was like, oh, I've got the perfect line for my review of More Jelly, Less Julie. And she just talked about herself the entire time. And I was like, stop talking about yourself. Talk about jellyfish. When you name the book Spineless, talk about jellyfish.
Yeah. So it's really more of a memoir that she used jellyfish as a tool for instead of the other way around.
And I mean, there were some interesting things in it about, you know, jellyfish, about how jellyfish are kind of like the harbinger of the sea, of the change in the oceans and, you know, various things like that. And whether they are or not, or whether it's the fact that we just have better recording devices now. And I mean, there were some really good things that were brought up in there, but she had these things that she harped on and just kept on coming back to, like her college boyfriend.
And
I was like, what in the world? Why is this even related at all to, you know, your research on jellyfish? And I think she thought it was cute or something. I don't know. I'm just not into that kind of memoir-y plus science thing. But I will say I have an exception to that, which I'll discuss in a little while.
Okay.
So I'm kind of going in order. I skipped around a little bit, but I was reading Spineless and Sixth Extinction at the same time.
Mm.
So Sixth Extinction by Elizabeth Colbert won the Pulitzer for nonfiction back in 2015. And I mean, absolutely deservedly so. This book it kind of blew me away. And I've read things in this same vein before, but the way that she just brings it home, it's an amazing book. It's definitely not a book that's going to make you feel good about yourself. You know, when you're talking about mass extinction, it's not something that would be called an upper. it's very existentialist. You know, it's like, well, can we even do anything? Will anything we do change, you know, where we're going? Are we on this path for extinction? But there's just these amazing points that she brings up and talks about, you know, previous extinctions in Earth's history. Looks at several species now and, you know, some of their decline and then some of them coming back and, you know, birds that have gone extinct because we've, you know, humans have over hunted them and various things like that. So just this Anthropocene epic idea that, you know, we're what's changing. Humans are what's changing everything now. And this is the first time in Earth's history that another species brought on this level of extinction.
Hmm.
So yeah, a lot to chew on there and not very pleasant, but it was an outstanding book and just the amount of knowledge inside of it.
Can I talk about one of mine just because it connects so much to that one?
Of course.
We'll go back to your list. About this one a lot on episode 131, so I don't need to say too much about it, but that book, Rising, Dispatches from the New American Shore by Elizabeth Rush, was probably my favorite read from Science September. Cause she talks about climate change and particularly and how it affects the shoreline of North America.
Mm-hmm.
And I was reading this as Hurricane Florence was approaching. And so it was really strange timing because there's a lot in there about Hurricane Sandy and how that affected the upper shore and how a lot of people who lost their homes in that particular hurricane were living in places that never should have had homes and all the different reasons and how wetlands are turning into rotting places. Like they're not even like living things anymore. And so yeah, it was same kind of thing where it's a little depressing, maybe super depressing, not a lot that can be done to restore it necessarily. At least the humans that have tried have made it worse. And so she talked a lot about how nature restores things versus what like the Corps of Engineers have tried and things like that. Especially exactly. when it comes to wetlands. And so, yeah, that was a really interesting book and it's brand new. So the science is really new. And she also did a lot of interviews with people. And then like these kind of stories came from different people's perspectives that were based on interviews that she had done. And so you have these people that their communities are disappearing basically, and they have to decide if they're going to stay or go. And so some of the people are people who've had to pick up and leave. And some people are like the last holdouts.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that. And
thinking
one.
Like how that story keeps on rewriting itself with every storm that comes.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, you and I both live in coastal areas, so we see it. We see it each summer, each fall when a new hurricane comes, and you see, you know, previous areas in the past where it was like, oh, that used to be, you know, where things were, and now it's flooded out and now no one lives there anymore. Or there's a few people who still live there or something like that.
Right. Like we haven't been able to go back to our favorite place in South Carolina since the last hurricane, because it demolished one of the parks we always go to. And so they're rebuilding it, which means they literally bring sand back in.
Yeah, exactly.
And they rebuild a beach that probably, if it were up to nature, just wouldn't exist anymore. You know?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I think here in Maryland, right on the Chesapeake, you're familiar with like the basic geography probably, but the way that the Chincoteague and the Assateague Islands that are on the other side, on the ocean side, they're barrier islands.
Yes.
On the other side of Maryland and Virginia. And, you know, back in the 1960s, there was this whole like push for beach house development in this area, which it's complete sand. I mean, yeah. you're just on this barrier island. And, you know, I think it was in 1962, there was some huge hurricane that came through and created this whole inlet, which has the great name of Assawoman Bay. That's actually the name of it. So Assawoman Bay was created during this hurricane and just completely washed out all this area that they were planning to make, you know, this big resort high-rise area. And yeah, now it's still underwater and it's Assawoman Bay and there's this big bridge over it. And that's kind of like the story of like, well, that's where that was going to be.
Right. So. Well, and I think Hurricane Matthew created a new inlet on the Outer Banks.
So yeah.
Now there's a new island, basically, which is crazy.
The Rising book is totally on my list. And I think I had seen it when it came out, you know, because I try to keep up on like the new science books that come out too. And I saw that and I put it on my list. And then I was excited to see that it was on one of the library ebooks. And I think that's where you got it. I think you got it on
Hoopla. I read it on Hoopla. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that reminded me that it's on there. And so I plan to get to that one soon. Mm-hmm. And you had a good review of it. So I'd like to read that.
Yeah. And you know, she's a creative nonfiction person. So she pulls in different types of writing. So it's partly nature journalism, partly interviews, partly narrative, but I don't think it goes to the extent of talking about her boyfriend, you know,
thankfully. Goodness. Oh man.
There's a line.
And maybe I'm being too hard on Julie Burwald.
Well, I think there are good ways of doing it. And then there are times where it doesn't work.
Yeah. Unfortunately I feel like that just, especially when the name of the book really relates to jellyfish, I just really didn't think there would be that much about herself in it. Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. But I mean, there were some interesting things I picked up from it, but that was kind of a disappointing book for me, especially considering the awesome cover.
It was a great cover.
So the next one I read, and I mentioned this a few moments ago, was a little bit more about bioethics and about intellectual freedom and how that relates to scientific inquiry, freedom of speech. So it's called Galileo's Middle Finger, Heretics, Activists, and the Search for Justice in Science. This is by Alice Drager. And Alice Drager is a pretty controversial figure in science and in science history. And over the past few years, she's been banned and been like little, you know, riots against her coming to speak at different universities and various things like this that you often hear, like kind of this outrage culture idea. Someone you disagree with, so you're not going to listen to them. You're just going to shout over them kind of idea. Anyway, she is a historian. She's a scientific historian, a science historian. And she focuses in this book on her background as an activist, but her complete commitment to making sure that activism has facts based behind it, scientific facts based on the activism. Hmm. And it's a very unique book. I've never read anything like this before. And her fight, her activism has been specifically around the rights of intersex people and how surgical and different ethical abuses that have happened to this community in terms of like normalizing a child at birth who has indeterminate sexual organs. And then, you know, the doctor deciding which one they should be and making those, you know, doing a surgery on the child without discussing with the parents, without, you know, these kind of things. So her activism has really focused specifically on that and, you know, allowing and the idea of, you know, allowing that person to grow up and then decide what they want to be. And of course it's hard. There's a lot of things that come into that as well, because the parents often want one way or the other, or, you know, this idea that it can just be kind of open, a little bit more gender neutral, that idea. So that's really been the focus of her activism. So she's done a lot of research specifically in intersex as well, and how that relates to basically human sexuality overall. But then she kind of broadens this whole idea into having good scientific information and the most recent research and, you know, listening to people who you disagree with.
Imagine.
Exactly. And then, you know, applying method, you know, those kind of things to their claims. And she really also draws a really important line in the sand about scholarly inquiry and the role of the free press in fact checking, and how that relates to both politics, how that relates definitely to scientific research. So she goes a lot more into other cases too, but then kind of keeps on relating it back to her own activism. So there's various medical cases of doctors who have done, you know, these surgeries on children, and then doctors who have given medications to people when, you know, it's going to be a genetic intersex situation where, you know, there's a gene that both of the parents have that will make their child much more likely to be intersex. And then kind of this hormonal pharmaceutical that's given to the woman while she's still pregnant to try to make that child not be intersex, and like all of these various things. So I had no idea. And of course I just was ignorant of this, because of course there's a big community around it, and I was aware of the community, but I had no idea about all of these pharmaceuticals that were involved and how common actually intersex births are. But she does talk a lot more about some other things too. So medical ethics is a big part, bioethics. And then she goes into this story of an anthropologist, Napoleon Chagnon. And I was familiar with this story, but I didn't know all of the details of it. And there was a book that was written a few years ago, The Darkness in El Dorado. And I'm forgetting the name of the author, but you know, when it came out, it was this heralded text about these anthropologists who were kind of running amok on the Yanomami people of Brazil and believe, Venezuela, and the horrible things that were happening down there, like medical experiments and kind of like Joseph Mengele kind of stuff.
Jeez.
Well, that's what this book claimed. But then when, you know, the fact-checking started to happen, realizing that none of that was actually going on, and the this anthropologist's reputation was completely ruined because of this book making these claims about him. And, you know, her, one of Alice Drager's hopes is that she can like dig and find some of these facts out herself. So she actually has done a lot of this work, and she's worked with Napoleon Chagnon, and he's the anthropologist who was pretty much, you know, tanked by this book. There were these various claims that they had, he and one of his geneticist co-workers had given the Yanomami people, I believe it was smallpox, just to see what happened. That was the claim in the book. And there was no proof of this in the book whatsoever. They just claimed it. There was no footnotes about anything. There was no corroboration of people who witnessed it or anything like that. So just this person made this claim, and the geneticist now has passed away, but Napoleon Chagnon is still alive. And over the years, now this book is being seen, like it's still available. I've seen it in bookstores, but it's becoming more well known now that, you know, this was a complete sham job, and that this guy's reputation was tanked by this person for, you know, making all of these claims. So it really draws home that point of like, do your research before you just jump on a bandwagon, before you believe everything that, you know, someone who you might politically agree with says. Like, do your research, because there's a lot more to the story. And it's much larger, of course, and it had had a lot of sociological and political elements in this as well. But I really liked her call to, you know, scientific inquiry. Free speech is important, but also back it up, you know, back up with facts, and you cite your resources and things like that. And I really liked that.
Huh.
So it
sounds interesting.
It so deep. And there was so much there. And this is one of the books I referenced earlier, where I started listening to it and I was like, I have to check the references in this. So I, luckily my library had a copy of this one, and I ended up reading the entire thing just because I wanted to see like exactly the way it was worded. I wanted to check the footnotes and the end notes and all that kind of stuff too. So
yeah,
it was a fascinating book. It's heavy, you know, it's really heavy. And I found out about this book from Sam Harris' podcast.
Mm-hmm.
He did a podcast about 2 months ago. It was called The Science of Gender or something like that. And his guest was, she's an endocrinologist or something like that, who studies specifically like sex hormones. And she mentions this book, and just kind of a passing book. And she's like, Alice Drager's amazing. Galileo's Middle Finger is one of my favorite books. And I was like, what kind of book is that? Looked it up, and you know, I immediately was like, I got to read this book. It's so interesting. And I'm really glad I did. And it definitely was the one that kind of pushed the boundaries on what I was going for with Science September, but it completely relates, this idea of, you know, free inquiry. And that's exactly what science is to test things and to question and, you know, listen to other people who you don't agree with. And it's, so I really liked that. And it did relate a lot to bio and medical ethics as well. So it was a great read.
Well, and I didn't mean to go back and forth between you and me, but it's so related to my last science book that I'm going to go ahead
please
and talk about The Demon Haunted World, Science as Candle in the Dark by Carl Sagan. So this is actually a book that Jeff on an earlier episode talked about, so I won't say too much about it, but it's all about just like pleading for people, like, please use the scientific method.
Yeah.
Use logic. Question claims, and it's written actually in the 90s, so there's a few things that are a little outdated, but he kind of tackles UFOs, crop circles, fairies, alien abductions.
Fairies.
And, yeah. Well, because it's like there are these time periods and people all believe in this and then they all believe in aliens and then they all believe, you know. So it was kind of interesting, the comparison there. And I listened to the audio, which is read mostly by Carrie Ellis. I don't know how you say his name. The Princess Bride guy, you know. And then some of the chapters are Seth MacFarlane.
That is like whiplash. Hearing you talk about, you know, my sweet Wesley, and then hearing about Brian the dog.
Actually, it's funny because I wasn't even thinking of them, though. So it somehow worked.
that when you mentioned that earlier, I was like, did she mean Seth MacFarlane?
Yeah, I actually looked it up to make sure that I had the guy right. But yeah, it's that guy. Oh, and there's also an intro by Sagan's wife.
His wife.
And it's like she records that one. So
do you think they were all in the same recording booth, or they were like in different parts of the country, and you know?
Yeah, probably. I mean, they never talk at the same time, so
that's so weird.
But the funny thing is, the book is from the 90s, but the audio version wasn't made until 2017. And so I couldn't help but think that this was a reaction to the whole fake news thing that has happened.
Yeah.
Like, this is how we know things are facts.
That's kind of
Carl Sagan, the king of facts.
Yeah. I like that. The timing's interesting to re-release it or to put it out again in audio.
So I guess it wasn't so much about science as it was about pseudoscience. But for someone who doesn't read a lot of science, and who this was my first audiobook that was related to science, it worked really well for me.
So that book sounded really interesting, but other than the audiobook narrators. So you talked about aliens. So that leads me into my next one.
Awesome.
I mentioned earlier about kind of going outside of my normal natural history, and I read Light of the Stars, Alien Worlds, and the Fate of Earth by Adam Frank. And this was pretty fascinating. I don't know necessarily how I found this one. Adam Frank is an NPR contributor, so I think I knew his name from that. And he's an astrophysicist, I believe up in New England somewhere. He's a professor at one of the universities up in New England. He kind of dips into... Well, he talks a lot about aliens in terms of, you know, not like these green little men, but like life on other planet kind of things. Mm-hmm. And whether that life is single-celled organisms, or whether that life is, you know, humanoid forms or something else. And talks a lot about the early planetary missions of NASA. And then there's a lot about Carl Sagan in here, obviously, tons and tons about Sagan, you know, and everybody's reverence for him. And then talking about exoplanets and life on those planets and relating it back to various things on Earth, and then projecting out to how those things formed, you know, how things formed in other places. It's kind of a survey, I guess you'd call it more of a survey book about astrobiology and relating to, you know, biology on these exoplanets. It was a good book for an introductory of that kind of thing, of, you know, of looking at this much larger idea. And kind of, I liked it because I read it right after Sixth Extinction. And this idea, you know, that here on Earth, this extinction over and over again, but then this idea also that it's much bigger than just what's happening on Earth. Hmm. And that there are possible extinctions going on all over our universe. And it was kind of an interesting companion piece on the heels of Sixth Extinction in that way. A lot about, you know, kind of futurism too, and what will happen in the future. I thought it would be a good textbook. I found it to be quite accessible. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I'm really describing it that well. Like I said, it was more of a survey, so there's a lot of information in here. It has some historical things about NASA, and then kind of like, this is what we hope to find in the next few years, but we're also open that we might not find that, might find something completely different. And it was neat. I liked it.
So did they talk about growing potatoes on Mars?
I don't remember that in this one. Not like in, you know, The Martian.
Yeah.
Not like in Andy Weir.
It's apparently more complicated than you would think.
Yeah, exactly. And don't you have to, like, use your own poop as fertilizer or something like that? So that I did like this idea too about, you know, kind of getting past the idea of humanoid forms as alien life, and yes, this the very idea that yes, other single-celled organisms, and this idea that there's water on other planets means there's life there. So that is an alien life, you know, not just whatever ET kind of stuff.
So yes, like it could just be mycorrhizal fungal networks.
Exactly. Exactly. There's a good chance.
Getting on the mushroom shuttle and go looking across the universe.
So that one was good, and another that I'd recommend if people were interested in kind of a survey text.
Yeah.
Moving along, I got into Lab Girl, and this is one that I was a little hesitant about, and we discussed it a bit, I think, while I was reading it. I started and stopped with this one. I wasn't sure if I liked it at first, and then I realized I didn't like it because I was listening to it, and I didn't really like the narrator, who actually ended up being the author. So while I thought she was a great author, I really had a much better experience with the book once I set the audiobook aside and actually read the book. So I enjoyed it a lot more after that. So Hope Jaron is the author's name, and she is a paleobotanist, something like that. She basically studies extensively ancient plant life, but she knows a lot about geology as well. So this book, you would never know it from the cover and from the name, has a lot more like hard science in it. And each of the chapters start with this really beautiful description of trees, of seeds, of plants as they grow, as plants have evolved through time. So this is very much back in my natural history corner. So I really did like that part of it. But her interspersed chapters on the plants and trees were just absolutely beautiful. You know, when I was talking earlier about Spineless and the memoir aspect of that book that I really disliked, this was also a memoir. And you know, this personal story that Hope Jaron tells throughout this book, I did have some problems with it, but then there were some interesting things because she was so honest in the book that I really liked. You know, she pretty much says straight up front that she has a mental illness, that she's bipolar. So there's a lot of things that come into play with her poor planning and her reaction to certain situations that she ties back and that the reader can definitely tie back to her mental illness. But she writes about it in a very brave way, and I did appreciate that. It never stops her from doing what she needs to do. She just has to work a little harder to make decisions, and she makes a lot of poor decisions. But that's part of it. I guess that's part of what makes a strong story.
Okay.
So it's her life just, you know, getting established as this geobotanist, which I think is a pretty rare thing. Not many people do that field of study, and, you know, scrounging for research money. But the biggest thing that you see about this book over and over again is it's a larger story of her relationship with her lab partner, who it's a completely platonic and beautiful relationship that they have, and his name is Bill, and he's pretty much just like a genius when it comes to engineering things. He Hope and him will discuss, you know, some piece of lab equipment that they want to build in order to do this test or something. And then she'll come in the next day and he'll have welded it or something like that. Geez. But he has these amazing, you know, geobotany skills that she has too. But then he's just really amazing with the machinery and putting things together. And it's a beautiful description of their relationship and how they went through this together and how, you know, they scrounged for research money. They lived basically in the lab for 22 hours a day. Sometimes, I mean, Bill was even homeless and actually lived in the lab because they had no money. So that part was really interesting. I mean, I also felt like it was so honest the way they describe, you know, poverty in scholarship as well and in scientific scholarship, because they're barely able to eat because they're all just living on grant money. Yeah, so it was very much of a memoir, but then I liked the mixture of, you know, this is what it's like to be a working scientist, and then the intersperse of the beautiful chapters and the writing. And now she's a very successful scientist and has, you know, pretty strong research funding now. I think she's at the University of Hawaii.
Wow.
But she bounced around a lot. She was at Georgia Tech. She was at Berkeley, I think, and then at Johns Hopkins for a while.
I feel like this book is always mentioned, and the way it's usually described is, this is what it's like to be a woman in science, but I don't hear you using any gendered language at all, so...
There are a few cases, especially towards the end of the book, where, you know, she meets someone and falls in love with him, and then they get married and she becomes pregnant, and like the situation of the way she's treated as a pregnant working scientist is very unfortunate. Hmm. You know, she's the only female that works in this, I think it's a geology department, and I believe it was at Hopkins, and just the way that she's treated, at least that she describes as being treated, was very frustrating. And I could see that being the case, that a lot of people were like, oh, this is what it's like to be a female in science. But I think this is just what it's like to be a scientist. A lot of the, you know, the scrounging bit that I described earlier.
Yeah.
What happened with her during her pregnancy was really unfortunate. It was like, and borderline illegal, probably, the way that situation was handled. I don't think she pushed, you know, for any sort of legal or human resources or anything, but they've pretty much sidelined her during her pregnancy and just didn't want anything to do with her anymore.
I just had the impression of it that it was that's all it was about, but that's just not what I'm hearing from you. It sounds just like it's life and science.
Yeah, that was more how I thought about this book.
And, yeah, and I'm not saying you're wrong at all. I'm just, you know, I feel like I'm getting different messages about the book from different people. It's very interesting.
I think it came out a little bit more in the second half of the book.
Okay.
And that's when, you know, she gets married and has a child and things like that. So that part, her role as a woman scientist became, I guess, a little bit more later on. But I think it was a bit of a role reversal thing, because for most of the time, Bill, her lab partner, was, you know, her subordinate. Hmm. And he relied on her for everything. Because she was the one who had the PhD. He did not finish his PhD, but was brilliant in his work and his, you know, his work ethic and everything like that. It's really about a dedication of their work together. She was very much the one who got the recognition because she's the one who had the PhD. That was kind of an interesting little, you know, difference. So I don't know if that part was so much about this is what it's like to be a woman scientist, because I think it would be more the other way around.
Yeah, it's kind of flipping the script a little bit.
One thing, and I told you about this earlier, that bothered me a little bit was I was like, who chose the title of this book? Because I felt like it was very diminutive, because she's clearly not a girl. And I don't know if she's the one who chose that, because girl, it just sounds silly. The title and even the cover art of the book, I didn't feel conveyed very well of what was actually happening inside of this book. I don't know if Knopf chose it. You know, this book was very well regarded and got a slew of awards, like the National Book Critics Circle Award for autobiography. It got the Penn E.O. Wilson Award for literary science writing. It got a lot of note and popular opinion too, because it won like the Goodreads Choice Award for memoir back in 2016. So a lot of people read it, and that's also a big red flag for me, is when a ton of people read it, I tend not to want to read it. I'm like, I don't know about that. But the fact that it had a big botany focus, I was curious about that. And I'm really glad I did read it. There were some passages in it. And I really liked some of her descriptions.
And I guess it's a good lesson. Not every author should read their own book. Or maybe if an audiobook isn't working, you should try the print in case that's all it is.
Totally. I was so glad that I had such a better experience once I stopped the audio.
Yeah.
And read it. I enjoyed it a lot more. And maybe that was because I got to actually savor the words a bit more with her descriptions of plants and trees, that I really liked that part. It was good. And I'm glad That's I read good. It. So the next book I read, another kind of natural history title, it was called How to Tame a Fox and Build a Dog. This was born out of this documentary I saw years ago about the Siberian scientists, the Soviet scientists in Siberia who were breeding silver foxes and then trying to domesticate them over a few generations. This is a pretty well-cited experiment in evolutionary biology, and you can find several references to it. I think what's so interesting about it is that it sounds just very Soviet. This idea that taking these foxes and taming them and making them being able to live in a house and things like that. They're truly like Siberia. They're out in these huge coats and, you know, living in these little huts and things like that. The geneticists in, I believe it was in 1959, and then it continuing up until maybe early 2000s even, these two geneticists, Dmitry Belyaev and Lyudmila Trut, they were the ones who forgot how many generations it ended up being. They were able to completely take this wild, you know, sometimes very fierce fox, and over time to domesticate a large number of these foxes, sometimes within 3 or 4 generations, to be able to hold them like a cat or dog and have them in your house and potty train them and all this kind of stuff. So these were wild animals that then people slept with and let their children play with them and things like that. It was really interesting. And there's a lot of information too about extrapolating. This is how dogs were domesticated from wolves and looking at it in this macro micro way. I mean, obviously this happened over a few generations and I don't think domestication of dogs happened that fast. It was a pretty extraordinary story. Lyudmila Trut, who was one of the geneticists in Soviet Russia who did this, was the co-author on this one. So Lee Allen Dugatkin, he traveled to Siberia and saw a lot of these foxes. Dugatkin is a biologist and he's a professor. He specifically focuses on evolutionary biology and animal behavior. So he goes a lot more into detail about that. And it was fascinating just about the evolution of these domesticated animals. And there are some amazingly cute pictures of these foxes.
Well, and I think it's interesting because I don't quite understand how that works, passing it between like different generations of a creature, you know, rather than it happening within the lifespan of one. That's hard for me to understand or wrap my head around. So I'd have to read it to get it.
it's a very it's a very easy book to read. They were taking and making these, you know, genetic hereditary charts for all of these foxes and determining the one that let you get close to it. The one that let you touch it, the one that looked into your eyes when you said hello and things like that. And those were the ones that they kind of self-selected out. And then it really, you know, it makes this larger point of, okay, which were the wolves that came around the camp? Was it the one that was friendly? Was it the one that let the children play with it and touch it? And then, you know, self-selecting domestication then? And then taking it into the same idea with the foxes. But, you know, that was a forced breeding situation. So they were able to pick this one, put these two together. And then they have, you know, litter and all these little fox kits and then same thing again. These farms, these Siberian fox farms were, you know, they were fox fur farms that were used to make jackets and coats and all the things that Siberian people use for clothing. And this was a really big industry in Soviet Russia, Soviet USSR. It was a state-sponsored genetics experiment to kind of domesticate these foxes. While this was kind of a little pet project on the side, it was a working fox farm where, you know, these animals were slaughtered for their fur to make jackets and coats and various things like that. So you got an interesting look at how outside of the Western view of science, of how things were kind of going in the USSR during the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, as this experiment was moving along. There was a big push against Linnaean genetics and following the idea of Linnaean genetics and then trying to make this own Soviet version. I think it was called Lysenkoism. Might be saying that wrong. And it was just something that was completely fascinating because I had never even really heard about it. A lot of scientists were trying to get out of that mold and push against and follow what was happening in the West, or what they could try to find out what was happening in the West in terms of you know, the burgeoning field of genetics at that time, and then doing their own research. So it was a good one. I really liked it. It's short and it's very readable. And one of the other people who, Laura of Books, who is in Hawaii, she's on Instagram, and she participated in Science September as well, and she was able to read this one.
Oh, good.
After I did, and she agreed. She thought it was a good one as well. So yeah, a quick read, and I liked it, and I'd recommend it, especially if you're interested in kind of like domestication.
I follow a fox or two on Instagram, people who have brought them into their homes because they can't live in the wild for whatever reason. And it feels like that's one of the things that the people who run those accounts are always saying to commenters who think they know better. No, they're never going to be potty trained. It's just not possible. They're wild animals.
Exactly.
So yes, they have demolished our house, but we can't change it. But we're caring for them because someone needs to.
See, that's really interesting, because I wonder if I don't know if the domestication process was the same then, because there's never any talk about like destruction of that these foxes do. Hmm. Like they were handpicked. These, you know, Ludmilla let her child play with them, and like one of her little girls slept with a fox every night and things like that. So I'm like, I don't know if you would have, I don't know if the foxes that you see that people have now are the same sort of domesticated versions. And well, I think
in this case, like the ones on Instagram, they were rescued after being like either abandoned or injured, but they started out as wild animals. So that's probably different in that sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think the important part is probably when they're born and what happens at that point.
Yeah. And like who their parents were too, and what their parents' demeanor and behavior was, and various things like that.
But, you know, I don't know if you do this, but when we rescue dogs, we look for a lot of the same things you were talking about.
Of course.
Like a dog that doesn't just want to go outside, but wants to like interact with you as a human. A dog who is responding to you and your voice, who makes eye contact. I mean, those things really matter.
Exactly.
For us. That's the temperament that we're looking for. Yeah.
And, you know, that's not, that's something that, if you watch any sort of these documentaries that are about wolves, they'll often mention that wolves will not make eye contact with a person, with a human. Mm. But, you know, every day our dogs make multiple eye contacts with us.
Yeah.
And sometimes like stare. Yeah. You know? And that's something that is so fascinating, just how quickly that switch happened. Mm-hmm. In just in terms of evolutionary time, how that happened, because and how quickly it can go back too. You know, this idea of a feral dog, you know, living out, and while they may not be wild, they're still that streak that kind of returns. So it's a fascinating idea of how quickly things can kind of move back and forth, and how that line is.
Totally.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure like my dog, he's just, one of my dogs is just a complete blub. He would not be able to live out in the wild whatsoever.
Yeah, no, neither of mine would.
But I think most dogs are like that, you know, and that's the way we've created them. Mm-hmm. Is they are reliant on us and we rely on them too. So.
Absolutely. That's why we're interested in domestication in the first place, probably.
Exactly. So I think as a dog lover, I really enjoyed reading this book too. So if you do like dogs, I'd recommend this one. Mm-hmm. Was there another one that you wanted to discuss? Because I feel like I've just been talking forever.
Well, I didn't get through anything else, but I did start Yeah, I've always wanted to read a book by Rachel Carson. She wrote Silent Spring, which was really important for environmental pollution back in the day. Uh-huh. I haven't ever read it. So I tried one called The Sea Around Us that was written by her, and it's all about the ocean and the importance of all the parts of the ocean interlinking and what pollution does and how there's all these different ecosystems. And the writing is actually really beautiful, and I was impressed by that. But it was from 1951, and I kept wanting to like fact check everything. Yeah. So I kept getting pulled out of the book just by wondering like, well, is that still what we think now? And how would I find out? And so I stopped reading it eventually because I just felt like I would have a better experience if I read something more current. And then I remembered this book that I kept seeing everywhere when I was in the San Juan Islands. And I really wish I'd bought myself a copy. I mean, I can just order one now, but it's the book I wish I'd read instead of The Sea Around Us. And so I'll just mention it. I haven't read it. I can't vet it or anything, but it's called Tides, The Science and Spirit of the Ocean by Jonathan White.
Yeah.
I can't tell you how many times I picked it up and put it back down. And I just know when that happens, I'm going to regret it later.
Oh, well, there's still that opportunity, Jenny.
Yeah, it still exists. I thought maybe if to give you a little bit longer of a break, I would talk about books that other people read about the ocean.
Please.
So Green Tea Reads read The World is Blue, How Our Fate and the Oceans Are One.
Yeah.
And then one person mentioned that they'd read The Soul of an Octopus, which isn't specifically about really octopus. It's really more about consciousness. Mm-hmm. And that made them want to read more about octopuses, octopi. So then they read this book called Sex, Drugs, and Sea Slime, Ocean's Oddest Creatures and Why They Matter by Ellen J. Prager.
And that's she was like highly recommending that one.
Yeah, that seemed like a really good one. And then, of course, other people who read Spineless.
So Karen at Green Tea Reads, what did she say? Earth, sky, and oceans. That's what she focused on. Yeah, because she read a book about clouds. And then she read The Hidden Life of Trees like you did. Mm-hmm. And then read this ocean book too. So it's kind of fascinating. She really covered everything there.
That's a good approach.
Yeah. And they're mentioning other people too. My next book that I was going to discuss was a little bit more about quantum physics. And there were a few other people who also read some physics books and quantum physics books, who used the hashtag this month. And another was Sean at Books and Beers. And he did, Sean M. Carroll's The Particle at the End of the Universe. We had a side conversation about that, and he was saying that it's pretty dense, but it's amazing. It's one of these books that you kind of have to wade through slowly because it's just so much information. And then The Physics of Everyday Things, which I've heard of this book a few times, and I actually had another book by this author in my stack, and I'll get to it at some point soon, James Kakalios. Hmm. And that one was by an Instagram person, Wynn Reads, who he read that. And then The Theoretical Minimum, What You Need to Know to Start Doing Physics. So it's kind of interesting. I appreciated us, people expanding and doing a little bit more than just kind of the natural inclination of just going to like biology books. So definitely appreciated some more quantum physics books. And it's something that has always kind of intimidated me. And that's one reason that I wanted to get into it a little bit too, and just try to understand. Of course, that's the point. You don't really ever understand quantum physics, I think. Yeah. So I read a graphic novel called Totally Random, Why Nobody Understands Quantum Mechanics, a serious comic on entanglement. This book threw me for a loop. It was very entertaining. I don't know if I learned anything more. I think I was more confused than anything after reading it. But it kind of takes this approach of, you know, this coin toss and the randomness of this coin toss and everything that can be applied to that, and applying it to the larger idea of quantum mechanics. So it looks at a lot of like the key physicists who were involved with the theories on quantum mechanics, and talks a lot about Schrodinger. And there's, since it's a graphic novel, there was some amazing cat imagery. I will say that there was some great stuff about just about the drawings were pretty hilarious. They were the style of the drawings for this one was very like ready made. They used it was like Dada. They just used all these weird imageries and like had some kind of collage art and like I said, like kind of used object ready-mades. It was a really interesting book. And they just kept on playing with this idea of coins. And it related more to like a casino and the randomness of a casino. And it had some cool stuff in it. Like I said, I don't know if I understand anything more about quantum mechanics. I learned who some of the, you know, the key players were and their infighting with like what Einstein said and what Niels Bohr said and what Schrodinger said. And that part was pretty entertaining.
Do you think the graphics helped?
They definitely were entertaining.
Yeah.
I don't know if they helped me understand anything more. Mm-hmm. There was another book about quantum mechanics and quantum physics that I wanted to check out. And that was, I think it's called like The Amazing History of Quantum Mechanics or something like that. And that's by that same author, James Kakalios, for the book that Wynn Reads read last month. That's the one that's on my stack. So I'll probably get to that at some point. But so
I noticed that Jeff Keppen, who's Dinsdale Keppen Instagram, but he read a graphic novel too, not about quantum mechanics, but it was called Soonish, 10 Emerging Technologies That'll Improve and or Ruin Everything by Kelly Weiner-Smith and illustrated, I think, by Zach Weiner-Smith. And I don't remember really much about what he said about the book, but there was this really cool thing where if you get the app, the Soonish app, and you point it at the book, then you get this 3D space elevator.
That looked amazing.
Yeah.
And the fact that he was able to show that on the photo, too, I loved it. Yeah, I was a big fan of that book, what Jeff was posting about that. That's something I'd like to see if I can find a copy of, because I want to try the app and I want to learn more about it.
Yeah, it's dangerous to write a book about the 10 big things or whatever, because as soon as you do, right, that's going to...
Yeah, you're going to be superseded. Probably. The next two were pretty quick ones. You know how TED Talks lately has been doing books of their TED Talks and that came out, I think, in 2014. And it's called How We'll Live on Mars. And it's by Stephen L. Petranek. And I don't know if we wrote that one down on my list. It was a late edition. It was only like a 96-page book. But It was pretty good. Again, it was a survey. It was, you know, a TED Talk version of like where we are in terms of Mars exploration and Mars habitation, and what would it take to, you know, get us to Mars, and what would it be like to breathe there and to build there, and you know, who's close to it. And so he talks a lot about, you know, the private industries now and the entrepreneurs like Elon Musk and Richard Branson and various people like that who are trying to get us there to Mars, and what it would take for habitation. Mm-hmm. This one, I feel like this one was made into an audio book on the heels of The Martian.
Probably, yeah.
Show. And then there was a show too that was on, I think, National Geographic Channel called Mars. And I looked later and found out that Mars book or Mars show was based kind of on this book. And that was actually a pretty entertaining show. I watched that movie I watched that show when it came out. It's a fictionalized scripted. That's what they're calling it.
Scripted drama or something.
Scripted drama. Yeah. So I think that they, you know, had not ventured into that territory yet. And they had some recognizable faces of, you know, people who you may have seen other scripted dramas and you know, Netflix shows and various things like that. And it was good. It was definitely heavy on the drama side. I remember that. But they're making a second season of it. It's just simply called Mars. And they left a pretty interesting kind of cliffhanger in the last one where they finally found water on Mars.
Oh.
Now they can live, you know, and now they can build a civilization around it. It was good. So I'll probably watch the second season. I think it comes out this fall. This book was a major part of that. So my husband and I listened to this book actually while we were driving up to the airport when we were getting ready to go on our recent trip. We listened to this together. And that was that one. And then another short one I read was more of like an essay discussion between Edward O. Wilson, the famous biologist, and former poet laureate of the U.S., Robert Haas. And it was called The Poetic Species. It's just, it was a nice discussion. It was some sort of like a script of I think they call it the conversation of these two people and how biology and poetry interrelate. As a poetry lover yourself, it might be something that you might be interested in. I found it to be very short. Yeah. I was able to get through it like, I don't know, in maybe an hour. It had some interesting little quotes in it, but I wouldn't say there was anything that completely stood out as like, oh, that was so amazing, I need to write that down. But it was good. And they talk a little bit about some of the controversies that Edward O. Wilson has found himself in previous years that he's kind of moved away from now, but this social biology and like what that meant and like determinism kind of stuff that, you know, there was a lot of assumptions that were made when one of his first books came out. And then the last book that I read for Science September was Machines of Loving Grace by John Markoff. This is a big, thick book. I started this one last year and put it aside and actually kind of thought I wouldn't go back to it. But over this past, it's been over a year since I picked it up, and I was like, maybe I should just get back to that. Maybe it just hit me at the wrong time. So I actually ended up just starting the whole thing over again and read the entire thing. And that it's kind of this larger history of robotics and AI and human interaction. So it's very much in the like computer science and robotics kind of vein of, you know, Science September. It's pretty exhaustive. There's just this kind of blow by blow of history of what's happening in Silicon Valley, what's happening at Stanford, what's happening at Berkeley, and what's happening at Boston Dynamics, and, you know, who's building this robot and who's building this AI. And it was a little much. There wasn't a vein that kind of tied it all together other than like, oh, and what's going to happen? Yeah, it's like, well, we don't know, but here, let's talk about Siri. and you know, it just kind of all leads up to that. So I felt, and I think any book like this that discusses robotics and AI, and even the Mars book I mentioned a few moments ago, you know, the minute they come out, there's going to be stuff that supersedes it. It's almost dated the minute it's published. There were some interesting things I picked up from this book, but I think there might be some other things that are some other books that may be slightly better in terms of like history of Silicon Valley and different technologies that have formed. And none of those are coming to mind right now. I haven't read that much in this field. I know there's a few that I've seen some that have come out and seen titles, so they may be a better representation than this one was. The title was so cool, though. I really thought it was
such a neat title.
And it has a cool cover image, you know, of this robot hand holding a human hand. And this is going to be good. And
so you get several of these for their covers, I think.
Oh, man, that makes me sound so superficial.
Well, I think it's smart. Like, you want to be pulled in. It's like food tastes better if it looks good.
Oh, that's true, maybe. Yeah.
I thought it would be nice to like at least run down the list of books that other people read for Science September. We won't talk much about them, but
yeah,
we've mentioned some of them already, so I won't mention them again. But I kind of categorized them because I'm a librarian and I can't help myself.
Yeah.
So under the History of Science, Jeff Dinsdale-Kep read The Clockwork Universe, Isaac Newton, The Royal Society, and The Birth of the Modern World by Edward Dolnick. And I saw that you wanted to read that one.
Yeah, I really liked his review of that.
Yeah.
That sounds great.
I grouped a bunch under Humans, Why We Sleep, Unlocking the Science and Power of Dreams by Matthew Walker. That was read by Lore of Books. Also the same user, When, The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. That was interesting to me, by Daniel H. Pink. And then Road Reads read It's All Relative by AJ Jacobs.
I think that's about genetics and family trees and things like that. Yeah.
Yeah. And then there's a few about like, oh, wait, just there's one about brains, Unthinkable, An Extraordinary Journey Through the World's Strangest Brains by Helen Thomson. Yeah, that sounded good. And then there's a few from someone in Litzy who wanted to play along Conservio over in Litzy. They read Dead Men Do Tell Tall. Dead Men Do Tell Tales, The Strange and Fascinating Cases of a Forensic Anthropologist by William Maples. And I was thinking about this book when you were talking about the anthropologists earlier, and like, maybe that's why people become forensic anthropologists, because then they don't have to deal with people.
Exactly. To deal with other anthropologists. They're like, I'd rather deal with dead people.
And there's one that I should have brought up when we were talking about the climate change type books, but there was one that looked good called The World Without Us by Alan Weisman.
Yeah, that book is really good.
Is it?
I read it when it first came out, and I really liked it. Actually, Jeff and I had some side conversations about it. And there was a documentary that came out based on that book. It was on one of the, it was either on Discovery or Nat Geo. Hmm. And, you know, they show these views of like a city of and what a city would look like after, you know, humans are not there anymore. And it's pretty fascinating.
Well, we just had the kudzu cleared from behind our house, and I can tell you that it won't take long.
It will not take long. And that's actually a big part of this book, just about like plants for one, and what plants will do, and you know, trees sprouting up and various things like that. The reclamation process does not take long.
I love to read about like what happened in Chernobyl, even, you know, and how fast the plants grew back and everything. I feel like I came at that idea from another angle. You know, I used to read tons of post-apocalyptic science fiction type novels, and so I've read like Earth Abides and all those books that talk about basically humans running themselves extinct and what happens after.
See, you have been reading science all along.
I know, just in this slightly tweaked version. So other people read about plants too. So there was Seeds by Thor Hansen, and I have seen that. I thought about that one several times. The Botany of Desire by Michael Pollan, of course.
That was a good book.
And Birds and Beasties, that's my other category. The Genius of Birds by Jennifer Ackerman. The Seabird's Cry by Adam Nicholson. Both of those were read by Shatterlings.
Uh-huh.
And H is for Hawk by Helen MacDonald. I've read that one before. It's very good. It's not all science. It's a memoir, a grief memoir. But it also talks about raising goshawks, which... it's fascinating.
I've heard reviews on that one.
It's pretty beautifully written.
So I'll have to give it a try, but someone, one of my friends around here was looking forward to it and was very disappointed, so I just kind of didn't read it.
Yeah.
But hearing your review, maybe I should check it out again.
Yeah, there is quite a bit of memoir in there, so I don't know.
I set myself up for that one.
There was a few beastie ones. No Turning Back, The Life and Death of Animal Species by Richard Ellis. Mm-hmm. And The Beauty and the Beast, Britain's Favorite Creatures and the People Who Love Them by Hugh Warwick. That one just looks like a
title.
Really fun read.
That totally does. It's great.
And one book that really fit under climate and weather was The Coming Storm by Michael Lewis.
Mm.
That sounded good.
That's a new one.
Yes.
That just came out like a few weeks ago.
Like brand new. And there are a few that refused to be categorized, so I put them together. One was, I think this was a graphic novel too, so I wish I'd mentioned it earlier, The Thrilling Adventures of Loveless and Babbage by Sidney Padua. So it's like a history of computer science, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, with Ada Lovelace.
Yes.
I've seen that book, but I haven't read it.
Looked fun. And then one last one, The Food Explorer, The True Adventures of the Globetrotting Botanist Who Transformed What America Eats by Daniel Stone.
That sounds great, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That's been on my list too.
There's this person in Instagram, I don't know their actual name, but their username is Read More Science. So that sounds just about right.
Yeah, I believe she's a science writer. I think she might either be studying science writing or science journalism, or she's recently graduated, but she's doing a lot of cool stuff on her Instagram page with you know, just advocacy work and science education, and it's pretty cool, so check it out.
Yeah, because obviously it's not September anymore, so these are like ideas for next year
or this month when we keep on reading science books.
Yeah, like all the books we started and haven't finished. Or Nature November, which we decided we could have.
Totally. It's interesting because I know a few other people have mentioned this too. I really like reading about like diseases and you know, evolution of diseases. There's actually a ton of books on this. Like, I've read multiple books on malaria and yellow fever. And one of the best books in terms of history of disease is Emperor of All Maladies by Siddhartha Mukherjee.
And I think I actually have that on our list and I must have passed it. Sorry.
That book is fascinating. It is a chunk. It's like 700 pages, but it reads so fast, and it's a history of cancer, and it's an amazing book. And Mukherjee is a really great author. Like, he just writes really well. He has another book that's on my radar that I'm going to get to hopefully very soon, and it's just called The Gene.
Yes, I've seen that one.
Yeah, it has that cool like Mondrian cover or something. It's just like these, you know, primary colors and things like that. It's really, he's a great author. So I'm looking forward to reading that one.
So I think there's plenty more science to read.
Yeah. Like several of these books that were mentioned that some other people read were already on my list. And then hearing their reviews of it, I was like, oh, I need to move that up. Definitely the one that Jeff mentioned, the Isaac Newton one, that one sounded so good. The Why We Sleep was already on my list, and I was hoping to get to it for Science September, but I didn't make it. But there's several good podcasts with that author. He kind of made like a whole podcast circuit. He was on Fresh Air. He was on Joe Rogan. You know, like all these big ones. It like freaks you out because he talks about what happens, you know, with sleeping less and less and what it can do to your brain function and cognitive abilities. And it's like I think it makes people
keep me up more to know.
Exactly. Well, and I wanted to read it, but then I was getting ready to go on this big trip, which, you know, like I was like, well, I'm going to have to deal with jet lag and I don't want to feel shamed about this book and reading this book. So I'm going to come back. So anyway, I'll get to it soon.
Yeah.
Now that I'm back.
Well, thank you for talking all science books with me. This has been great. Hopefully we give people ideas of books to try and
venture
outside your comfort zones.
I will always be reading more science books. Yes, and hopefully you will too.
I think so. I think that Sweetgrass one is calling my name.
Yeah, that's a beautiful book. I'm like halfway through it and I really, really love it. I think you will too.
Yeah, I think it's in Hoopla, so that makes it easy.
Is there anything that you did not finish that you are hoping to get back to or like
speak to? Yeah, all my Alaskan books. It's just more like, I kind of feel like I don't want to just speed through them or, you know, read them while I'm reading too many other things. And so then I put them aside because I want them to be sacred, but then I don't have the time.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping to. I at least need to finish the Caribou one so I can return it to its owner.
That sounds cool.
Yeah. Thanks for listening to the Reading Envy podcast. You can follow me on Twitter at Reading Envy, or find a complete listing of our podcast episodes, as well as all of the books discussed on today's episode, at readingenvy.com. Don't build your house on the sandy land.
That's exactly what I was just thinking about.